This episode of the Tech Central podcast is brought to you by Pinnacle, Africa's top ICT distribution business, delivering the exceptional every time. I'm Duncan McLeod, and you're listening to the Tech Central podcast. I'm on Johannesburg's West Rand now to talk to one of the country's top chief information officers, Len de Villiers, who has just retired from Telkom, where he has been CIO for the past 4 years. Len has an extensive career in IT management, having served as CIO for some of South Africa's biggest companies, including three banks, Nedbank, FNB, and Absa. He's joining the podcast today to take us through his career, to talk about the state of IT leadership in South Africa, and also about, or rather how, the role of the CIO has changed over the years, and I'd imagine quite dramatically. Len, welcome to the podcast, and thanks for taking time to talk to Tech Central today.
Thank you, Duncan.
Take us through your career. What was your first job, and how did you get into the IT leadership role?
Well, my first job was, I grew up in Cape Town, and I went to school. My parents lived there. So when I left school, I looked for a job that would pay me for the period that I had to do my military service. And I looked around, and people told me about the Cape Provincial Administration and some opportunities to become computer operators. And I looked at that, and they said they would pay me if I had to do my military service. And I joined up and started my IT career in that particular area of South Africa. And from there on, I just grew into it and became an IT person for the rest of my life. So that's how I started.
So did you have a keen interest in computers and IT?
Yeah, I did at that stage. It was very, very different then. It was mainframes by and large.
Yeah.
Lots of tape handling and batch processing and card processing. So that's just my entry-level introduction into this world.
That was back in the 1960s, was it?
It was in 75.
75, okay. 75, sorry, I'm making you sound older than you really are.
No, it's fine.
All right, so you've held a range of top CIO jobs in South Africa. Take us through a few of those.
Yeah, after CPA, I joined BP South Africa as their head of networking and facilities. And from there onwards, I moved to Johannesburg to join a company called Metro Cash & Carry, part of the Kirsch Group, and also as facilities manager there, and eventually became the GM of IT in Metro Cash & Carry. It wasn't long after that when Canheim, part of the Gencor Group, got hold of me. I joined them as the general manager IT. And that lasted for 2 years. Then I joined First National Bank. And that was in the days when we did the huge ICL to IBM conversion, the massive migration to Hogan, and the huge risk of doing that big bang over 1 weekend conversion of the whole bank. Mm. That was probably the biggest conversion or migration that I was ever part of. After that, Nick Frangos got hold of me and persuaded me to join his group.
Just remind me which group that was?
That was the Microdata company. They had they bought Joffe Associates in those days, and Nick asked me to come and run that company for him. We changed the name to Microdata, mm-hmm. South Africa. And it was by and large a distributor of personal computers. In those days, PCs were the topic of the day.
Early 80s.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Everybody wanted PCs. And it was still the days of the early days of Microsoft. And is it Windows or is it going to be Apple or mm-hmm. and so on? And so I ran that for a year and a half, 2 years. Then Barry Hoare from Nedbank, who was the group CIO then, asked me to join him to help him at Nedbank, which I then did. And I then focused on operations, bank operations primarily. I had the IT development and network architecture responsibility, but then they gave me the operations responsibility of branches as well. So those were in the days when Chris Liebenberg was the chairman, and and Richard Laubscher was the CEO.
Was that when Nedbank made that hostile bid? Was it for Standard Bank?
Yes, that was in those days, and Michael Katz was helping us with the transaction. It was obviously not allowed by the Reserve Bank and the government, and they said no. I know that was Trevor Manuel was the finance minister in those days. And they said no to the deal. So, our ambitions were a bit cranked, but I think that was to be. We also did that very big Dimension Data partnership, which you recall. Mm-hmm. And then Barry became the head of strategy for Nedbank, and I took over from him as group CEO. And Tom Boardman assumed the CEO position for Nedbank, and I did work with him and his team in that role for about 7 years. And then I got a call from APSA, the same procedure. I joined them. And
do you have a cooling off period between these companies?
No. Straight one into the other.
Wow.
Joined APSA Bank as group CIO, and we started a strategic program to consolidate and build the one APSA brand and strategy. We were in our third year of executing against that strategy when Barclays became more powerful in the shareholding of APSA, and a strategic decision was made in London to drive the technology strategy of the group more from London. So I got some calls from London, say, come and see me. And they then made a decision that all IT decisions, strategy, investments, everything will be driven by Barclays out of Canary Wharf. And we were told to really adopt that strategy, the principles, the procurement, the guidelines, the security rules, everything had to be Barclays driven.
That must have led to quite a bit of unhappiness given
it
all
was,
the work you put in.
Because they were asking us to close out all our data centers, migrate all the Randburg and Town data center operations to Ratbrook Hall and Poole in the UK. I didn't agree with that, and I decided to rather, part ways.
Mm-hmm. And now, of course, Barclays has exited, or is exiting its stake from APSA, and now they're going to have to go back to what was there before.
What we were doing. So exactly that. So the five-year strategic plan that we were busy with and executing quite well has to be restarted all over again.
Sure.
We had differences of strategic opinion. We were quite strong on our views that you can't migrate data centers of that magnitude and run them out of the UK for South Africa.
So all transactions and everything would go via a submarine cable to the UK, be processed there and come all the way back again.
And it wasn't viable because just if you knew anything about IT, the propagation delay on those lines and those wouldn't have worked at all for ATM withdrawals, for internet banking. It just wasn't possible. But, they wouldn't listen, and they came down here with quite a hard hand and started doing that. And they, of course, weren't successful. I think the people soon found out that moving the data centers just wasn't going to happen. They are now busy in the process of redoing everything. And it's a massive, massive reinvestment to uncouple all the systems and start again.
Yeah, it almost seems very expensive, like a decade mistake. Of wasted time.
It's 10 years of wasted money, resources, and investment. And a lot of the top skills in APSA was lost as a consequence of that decision. But water under the bridge, it was done. Very big, expensive lesson to learn.
So what did you do after you left APSA?
So when I left, Mark Lamberti contacted me. He had just become this chief executive officer of Transaction Capital. And he said to me, please come and help me run the Transactional Capital Technologies for the companies of Transaction Capital. I joined Mark and focused really for the first year on Bayport, which was a micro lender, unsecured lending company. Everybody knows about Bayport. They're in Africa, quite significantly, but also in South Africa with branches everywhere, and they do unsecured lending. So I helped that for a year and a half, and then Transaction Capital decided to list, which they went to market with. And soon after that, Mark Lamberti decided to leave.
He went to Imperial.
He went to Imperial.
Yeah.
I got a call from Telkom, and Sipho Maseko asked me to come and help him with Telkom.
Okay.
And that was November 2013. And initially I signed up for 3 years, stopped and ended after 4 years and 6 months, and retired from from Telkom now. We had a very good run, the four years, 6 months. The company was restored to profitability. I mean, the share price grew properly. The whole service ethic was strengthened. Low-hanging fruit like infrastructure and properties were re-looked at, and the technology had to be reconsidered, and we implemented a lot of new systems, new OSS, BSS systems, billing systems for Telkom.
You overhauled the OSS, BSS system. What is an OSS, BSS system?
The OSS stands for Operating System Support, and the BSS component really reflects all the business system support. But it would, in our terms, in more layman's terms, the OSS is the underlying operating systems. And then you've got middleware that aggregates between the OSS and BSS. And then the business support systems, all the ones that interface to the customers, the presentation layers, and the look and feel of the front-end systems which customers engage with. Now, the OSS-BSS complexity that prevails in telcos are incredibly complex, and it takes huge amounts of investment, money, and time to overhaul these. We started that in November 13, and we have completed the OSS BSS migration now for consumer completely, where all their mobile and fixed customers are on one stack, which gives them one point of call, one reference, single view of customer. It can do all their billing, the charge out, the fulfillment, the installations, everything. So it's a very big achievement for Telkom, because from our understanding, according to Gartner, Meta, and Forrester, there are only 6 telcos around the world that have managed to do this for mobile and fixed on one platform. So complex, very hard, day and night, weekends, many, many thousands of hours of change, testing, migrations. It was, and it's done. It's wonderful.
So what did the system look like before, and what does it look like now, and what can it do now that it couldn't do before?
Well, before it was very standalone. It was based on isolated legacy systems passing the various pieces of fulfillment, assurance, billing from one system to the other. There was no single view of customer. It was difficult to maintain and run. If you change one component, you had to do a whole host of integration, volume, stress testing. It was just a very, very difficult. And the legacy systems, Telkom is 140 years old. Mm. And some of those systems were done in the late 70s and 80s. And very hard. Some of them end of life. The hardware they run on cannot be supported any longer. So we had to move off them. And, you know, like all CIOs, they battle to move from legacy to new. And the challenge is to get the new ready so you can switch off the legacy. And the other challenge is it costs you twice as much to run your IT if you've got old and new.
together.
It's a big pressure point for CIOs to persuade their boards and their excos that running the old and the new side by side is necessary until you can move all the customers across.
And SIPO supported you in this
process? Yeah, SIPO was my main supporter. Yep. I think he understood the complexity. He gave me the freedom to do the job. It was not easy. There was a lot of business challenges that we had to endure and overcome, but it was done. Yeah, and I think that's one of the things, the lessons I've learned as a CIO over the last 30 years. If you don't have your CIO's support, rather go fishing. It is just not worth it.
Yeah.
And if you do have it, you've got such a bigger chance of success in your job.
Yeah. So what platform has Telkom standardized on now? Is there a base? I don't know how these systems work. Is it an ERP system that sits at the base of it? Or?
Billing, fulfillment, and insurance platform. Now, the board of Telkom in 2011-12 made a strategic decision after some rigorous RFI and RFP evaluations to select Amdocs as the platform of choice. And when I arrived, the decision had been made, so I had to just get on with the job and do it. Now, it is a very complex system, but Amdocs is also the top OSS, BSS company in the world. They're in the top quadrant of Gartner, and they basically do this for the top 168 telcos worldwide. So they knew what they were doing. We had direct support from them from overseas, and they had quite a strong, good, experienced team on the ground to do it with us. Yeah.
Let's talk a bit about the role of the CIO in the modern organization. Yeah. What would you say are the top three things a good CIO brings to an organization? And what do good CIOs do inside their organizations to help the business? And what are some of the common mistakes you find they often make? Sure.
So, when I took on my first CIO role and I look back at what that meant and how that role has evolved, you can imagine how technology has changed over 30 years. I mean, when I did my first CIO job, there was no internet. There wasn't even mobile phones. There were page boys. And the challenge for CIOs is to adapt and adopt and change year after year with tech. And it's not easy for CIOs to constantly keep up with the change. Mm. So good CIOs today are people that can blend and mold the integration of business with IT. The biggest challenge that I see at the CIO Council, where we meet four times a year with the top 200 CIOs of the country, the CIOs are all struggling with the alignment of business with IT. Business is impatient. They don't have the time to waste. They must keep up with the markets. They must produce, they must sell, they must market, they must make money. And CIOs are generally found to be too slow out of the starting blocks. They cannot keep up with the pace. And I've seen it that we used to deploy quarterly and make massive changes to systems and infrastructure and applications quarterly. That's long gone. Then we had to move it to monthly, then weekly. It's now the majority of the organizations worldwide still introduce massive change over weekends. But that's not enough, and companies are forced to do changes daily. So you schedule hardware implementations on the Monday night or the Saturday night. You do big deployments on the Sunday night. You do database refreshments on a Wednesday. You do upgrades of certain laptops and desktops on Friday mornings. It is an ever, never, ever. It doesn't stop. And so the problem with that is the CIOs must balance the risk of having a patient in ICU and in surgery all the time, because you operate all the time and everything changes all the time. So the stability challenge is big, the change and problem management challenge is big. and managing that is probably one of the biggest issues now. Now, the other big success factor for CIOs is to be able to understand the company's strategic intent, to blend that strategic intent with the IT strategic plan, and to show the business how that plan is aligned, and show it very clearly, to build on the prioritization of the company, to prioritize properly with the organization on what you should be doing and what you shouldn't. Now, CEOs find it very difficult to prioritize because everything is urgent. And so CEOs, successful CEOs, have that skill and capacity to say, these are my top 10 priorities for this organization. CIO, align to those and drive them through. Now, that makes the life of a CIO very easy, but by and large, that doesn't happen. And business units fight for priority, and there's a lot of priority conflict. And CIOs are in the middle of that, and they become very unpopular because everything is urgent and everything is important. The last but not least is the CIO's challenge to be a leader of people and get the best talent in the team. And I always refer to the All Blacks. I say, if you want to be a successful CIO, you have to have All Black players in your rugby team. They've got to be the smartest, the quickest, the best. And they've got to be very, very capable of executing on the strategy. The other challenge that CIOs have is to keep their people and talent, because they are being poached. As I've just told you, I've been poached my whole life. They poach and steal everybody's talent. So that's a big issue. Successful CIOs have a way of keeping their people, motivating them, giving them the freedom to grow, and letting them do their jobs. I guess those are some of the big ones.
Yeah, I'd imagine a lot of IT leaders would naturally tend to come from a technical background, and so therefore perhaps don't have the management skills or the people leadership skills that this role demands. Do you see that a lot? Do you see techies coming into the CIO role who love technology but aren't necessarily that good at actually interfacing with the business and understanding the strategic issues?
So CIOs, I always say you get CIOs and you get CIOs. You have some companies where a CIO has 3 staff, 2 printers and a laptop. And then there's companies, CIOs with 1,000 or 2,000 people in the IT team. So by and large, the smaller IT shops have a more technical person that came through the ranks and have grown up into become the IT GM or the IT manager. Then they say, well, let's change the title. But by and large, it's not a C-suite position. So you do still find a lot of CIOs being very technical and love to talk bits and bytes and, you know, talk in the languages which the company doesn't understand or appreciate. But CIOs are becoming more and more business-driven, business-focused, with a very good understanding of what is the business all about, what makes the business work, why does the business exist, how does the business make money, what are the drivers of the business in terms of its value proposition. And then once you have that, you can then articulate the strategy of tech and how the tech supports that. Then there's the argument of, is IT as a business enabler or a strategic value added component of the business. I think that argument's also gone, because most companies cannot do without IT. If you switch the IT function off in the company dies. And so that argument's gone. And although a lot of leaders don't like that, to say, well, IT is the heart of the organization, it is definitely that. There's very few companies that you can name me that can operate without their IT function being on and available. And so it's becoming the heart of the organization and the network, the blood veins to every part of the business.
Out of interest, do you prefer working with CEOs who are tech savvy or ones that don't really understand the technology?
Well, I mean, I don't prefer either. I think there is a necessity to work with CIOs that do not have the full understanding of what the tech is all about, and that's the majority of CIOs. So you're going to have to be able to build that bridge and, you know, work with those CEOs. Boards are a bit more of a problem because very few board members, non-exec directors, have the required IT background or skill to deal with the complexity, and they get very concerned about the size of the investments they have to approve at board, and so they always fall back on some advisory capacity, a McKinsey's, a Bain, a Deloitte's, whatever, and they find themselves into a difficult position to approve or not very large, substantial amounts of investment in technology.
How can that be fixed?
I think you need to get some IT skilled board members.
Do they exist?
I think you can find them if you look for them. Mm-hmm. I do think they do exist. There's a lot of experienced IT veterans and executives that are available for these positions on boards. Yeah. And even if you don't want to make them a full board member, make them a member of the board subcommittee of technology, and bring some IT experts onto the board subcommittee that helps the board with very big complex decisions. Because it is now by and far the biggest decision that boards make in their fiduciary duty as members of boards. Because it's hundreds and thousands of millions of rands.
So, Len, you've mentioned you've worked on some big projects in your career. You mentioned the FMB one as being possibly the biggest IT project that you've worked on. But take us through some of the more interesting projects that you've been involved with during your career. Mm. What were some of the highlights for you?
Yeah, I mean, the FMB one was considered the biggest because of its risk profile. It was a big bang migration, which is always the highest risk. It's open heart transplant versus just surgery. So over that weekend, it was a one specific weekend, when we changed 29 ICL-29 systems over and switched them off and moved all the data with tapes onto the mainframe.
Oh, tape.
The tape migration. We flew the tapes up with aeroplanes.
Wow.
To Joburg and...
Chartered flights
and get the records downloaded and the migration done. So that was the risk of that twice big. Other big projects were in NetBank. We had a particular problem with technology systems and audits and working in the branches with a proper branch systems. And Barry and Tom Boardman put me in charge of all the branches. So suddenly 16,000 people in all the NetBank branches reported to me. They said, you run this thing now and clean up the back office, which were really the back office support and all the tellers, and make sure that all the EDA audits, which were unsatisfactory, are cleaned up and there's process and proper controls. And for 4 years, 5 years, we worked very, very hard in putting in back office procedures, automating back offices, streamlining the systems, and working on the audit findings. And what was quite amazing was, at the same time, we had to optimize the expenses, because very expensive back office operation filled with lots of people. And we did do that over 5 years, with a 0% budget increase on all the expense lines for 5 years. Hmm. And what we did was automate and eliminate manual process, automated home loans, automated current accounts, processes and teams, automate every investment team in the back office, and just cleaned up. And I think that was quite important. And then, you know, we... at the same time, we overhauled the card systems of Nedbank. There was a lot of investment at the time and just cleaning up the technology, which is today, I mean, you can see that Nedbank's tech and their delivery components is based on a very solid base that was laid for years ago. And the team that took over from me at Ned are the team that runs it today still. So Fred Swanepoel and the teams that were part of my team are still running it today and just progressing along the same strategic road. The other big one was, of course, APSA, where we had major problems with data centers. We had to build and establish the Randburg data center properly. We had to put in hyperchannels. We had to load down a duplicate copy of the production world of APSA down in Randburg, and then we had to do data replication between the data centers, real-time data replication, and then test, switch off the main production system in town, run on the Randburg system.
While it's live.
And make sure it works.
Yeah.
And we had auditors, internal and external auditors, in checking that all the systems work. It's a big thing.
Yeah.
But it's now part of the CIO's day-to-day function. Every CIO today has to prove that his DR systems and business continuity is in place, is tested and working.
Yeah.
With real data running real live.
Mm.
Very, very difficult. Now, and also now today, the new big thing for CIOs is cybercrime plan and cybersecurity, and making sure that the CIO drives that plan, coordinates it, puts it in place, tests it, monitors it, and constantly update that plan with all the necessary software and monitoring and protection that is required from CIOs to mitigate the risk of cybercrime.
Did you have any, I mean, talking about disaster recovery, in your career as a CIO, did you have any major disasters that almost stopped your heart?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, in Nedbank, I was sitting in London with the London teams, and I got a call from my head of operations at the time, Willie Scholz.
I remember Willie, yes.
From IBM, he was CIO. Willie called me and said, a virus has just hit our servers and it has started spreading. And our bank is being crippled. The servers are all dying one after the other.
Yeah.
And I was sitting in the worst place possible. I was sitting with Jim Sutcliffe in London on some meeting. And I had to tell my boss's boss that our bank was down.
Hmm.
Got on the plane, came down. And it took us 2 to 3 days to restore and recover the servers, which was hit by some
Was it
virus.
A cyber attack? Or
it was a malware attack.
Was it deliberate?
I think it was just a virus that came in that we weren't prepared for. And And it always comes through one or two servers which you don't know about.
Yeah.
So the risk that CIOs these days have is these rogue servers that are purchased by business units, unauthorized, quote-unquote, illegal, quote-unquote, and they just attach it to the network and they run it under their desk. It's quite private, you know, and nobody knows about it. And that's where the virus can come in, and once it's in, it proliferates and it gets first server, second server, and that is it.
Mm.
So that was it. We were down for 3 days. I had a similar one at APSA. We also had a virus problem at APSA. Again, comes through a department that's very unknown, somewhere in the very large organization. The server is under a desk, hasn't been backed up, it hasn't been secured, it doesn't have the necessary firewall software. It's used for some standalone application, and the business unit usually says, look, this is a safe thing. It's not connected to any network. You don't have to worry about it. We run it. We back it up. Don't stress. It's fine. It's really very safe. That's where they come in.
Mm.
Now, when that happens, there's nowhere for the CIO to hide. He or she is on the hook, and they've got to deal with it.
So
we've had it.
Shadow IT, I think they call it.
I call it rogue IT or rogue squatter IT. Camp IT. where people just build, you know, one system upon the other. There's no architecture. There's no design. They just build it. They just build an interface. They just pass data. The data is received ad hoc. You know, it's updated. And what you find then is when these big production systems have to consolidate and do their month ends, there's always some other database that has to be run on the side to validate what this system has done, to validate the final numbers. And that's why companies take 6-7 days after month end to run their finals, because it's spreadsheets and this and that, and they check it on this one and that one, and it never ends.
So how have you dealt with rogue IT in the companies you've worked for?
The challenge with rogue IT is you've got to be strong with it, because it's like security to a house. You've got to be very vigilant around that. I have always had the support of a CEO that says, no rogue IT, all IT must be within the IT function. And the IT function is accountable for all IT. And how we deal with that is we close the taps on the budgets of business units to spend on IT. But there's always a loophole. Mm-hmm. They always find money. What you find is most companies complain that IT is too expensive in their companies. And they usually measure IT as a percentage of revenue or a percentage of OPEX, of total spend. They say that's too much, 6% or 8%. It's totally too much. But what you then find is the rogue spend. If you get your hands on the rogue spend, you'll have adequate money for IT. So the business units can find money for IT much better than IT themselves. And the secret is to get hold of that spend and to consolidate it and to put some management over it and control it. That's always a challenge for most, if not all, CIOs, is to have a full view of the total spend of IT in their companies.
What about the emergence of what they call BYOD, or bring your own device? Obviously, everyone is carrying a phone in their pocket now. I think in the majority of cases, that phone hasn't been bought by the company. Mm. They're bringing it into the organization. They're using it for work. It's probably connected to the mail server. It's possibly connected to other IT systems. Mm. They're bringing other devices in, iPads, laptops, all this sort of thing. What impact has that had on trying to keep a lid or maintain management of IT?
Yeah, I think in the beginning, it was a major issue around BYOD. And some companies forbid it. Mm-hmm. Some they just said absolutely no. It became a big issue for companies and for employees. And some employees wanted to do their own thing. They wanted to have their own devices. And I think what was eventually the outcome is companies had to accept that you cannot stop this thing. You got to find a solution for it. And the solution is in building the capsule around the device for business and separate that from private. Now, that is also not always easy, because if you've got access to your mail on your laptop, on your cell phone, you've got to find a way of securing that email, backing it up and making sure that it is safe and secure. In most of the companies, they do allow bring your own device now, but the security rules and the separation of private versus business is very important, and there's rules around that and who the access of it and how you are being held accountable for what's on your phone whilst you're an employee. So the way they cover it now is through policies, regulations, some software, and they build those dividing walls so that people can't leak business information to people that shouldn't have access to it. By and large, it's governed by policies, principles, and rules.
Mm. Yeah. Let's talk a bit about skills and perhaps people who want to get into this space for the first time, what advice would you give to a youngster listening to this podcast who, you know, maybe someone in school or someone in university who thinks they might want to pursue a career in IT management and ultimately become a CIO as well? What would you tell them to focus on?
Well, one of the things I'm quite fascinated about is the fact that computer science graduates who will graduate in 2018, once they graduate, will know very little about the new technologies that they will work on going forward. So it's now well understood that a lot of the curriculums that are being taught at varsities for computer science are sort of outdated because the technology has moved on so quickly, so fast, that they almost have to start all over again. Having said that, a career in IT is fantastic because that's where the world is today. That's where the world's moving towards. Technology is the in thing. It's the revolution of the day. And you will never be found to be wanted if you pursue a career in technology because it's so fast moving, so exciting, and it's a hot, most critical topic for most companies and most businesses these days. And as you know, there's a huge shortage continuously for good IT skills, and IT functions are becoming more and more critical in businesses. So I think I would still support everyone who wants to really get into an IT career to do that, because first of all, there is good money to be made if money is important to you. There is good growth opportunities. You can work anywhere in the world if you're an IT person. Most countries are looking for IT skills. Most people want your type of skill. So I'm very supportive of it, and it's been a good choice for me. And you must just make sure that you keep up with the pace of what happens in tech.
Because, just keep learning.
Yes, you cannot read enough. You cannot learn enough. You can't attend enough conferences, seminars, workshops, management development programs. It's never ending, never ending.
Does it matter that the universities are perhaps a bit behind in the technology? I mean, given that it's almost a lifelong learning, this industry, this profession rather, does it matter that what you're learning is perhaps a little bit outdated? Is it not more about understanding the basic concepts and maybe instilling the ability to continue to learn?
No, I mean, I don't say everything is a waste. Mm-hmm. What the varsities teach you today, I think a lot of it still is relevant. It tells you about the underlying constructs of technology, how technology works, what are the hardware platforms of choice, how did they get to be where they are today. I mean, mainframes is a swear word these days. People say, what, you're still working on mainframes? Well, mainframes are still there for the big, big, big functions, and supercomputers are quite sexy and starting to, you know, map the DNA components of the human race. And so there's a lot of supercomputer activity that still keeps the mainframe touch. But so has servers developed, and so now the app stores are coming through with applications being launched. I think the latest was 600 a minute, mm-hmm. new apps on the App Store every day. So who can keep up with that, and how do you keep up with that? But I am the underlying foundations which computer science degrees teach you are still relevant. The development, the routines, the coding, the compiling, the releasing, the change management, very good. It's still relevant. It's just the how changes and the opportunity for developing on certain platforms with new languages and new protocols and new styles is so pervasive and so available to everybody. The other challenge is everybody sort of knows a little bit about technology in the 2018s. And the kids are quite smart with mobile technology and internet technology. and they navigate themselves very, very comfortably, and they've got no restrictions, they've got no fear. They show their CEO dads and their board member dads of how to work the iPad and how to, you know, and how to load down their board documents and how to find a particular document. It's quite fantastic. And I've heard so many CEOs that says to me, my daughter told me to do this and I must change that and update this. And my son has helped me with this problem on my laptop. I couldn't print, I couldn't scan, and he just got the app downloaded and the driver was downloaded and we're working. So I think the learning is constant. Mm. It's constant. Even today, I cannot keep up with what's happening.
If you were starting your career again now in 2018, is there a particular IT discipline that you would focus on? Is there something that would particularly excite you if you were a youngster coming to this industry right now? I'm thinking something like AI or machine learning or...
I just think that everything has changed, but what is quite exciting today is big data, because it's so important in every company to have some form of data warehouse where you can have information relevant to your company and that you can work that data and work and analyze it and mix it and find learnings from it that could help you sell more, distribute faster, reduce costs, market a particular segment for a product, check at your profitability of your company, find out the movements of your customers, the positioning. So big data and analytics is basically a new option for CIOs and companies to say, really tell me what's going on in my business. Mine this data, process it, and give me some insights. So people saying with big data and analytics, the insights we have enables us now to do everything in our company smarter, based on facts, based on information that we have. And companies buy data downloads and big amounts of data from various institutions and drop it down onto their databases and then mix it with what they've got to see what's relevant and what's not relevant, what they should continue with, what they should stop, should they be in this market, in that segment, yes or no. Very, very insightful, and people that have good analytics are more successful than those who don't. It's as simple as that.
Lynn, let's move on a bit. I understand you chair the CIO Council of South Africa. Mm. That consists of the country's top 200 CIOs, you said. Mm. Tell us a bit about that council and what it does, what its purpose is.
Yeah, it's been going for 7 years. This year will be 8. We started it 8 years ago. And there was a need for a body or a group of people in a CIO community where we could come together and talk about the challenges that CIOs face. By and large, CIOs have similar challenges, you know, and they have similar problems which they try to solve. They've got similar objectives. They've got a similar role profile and outcome. And so we said, let's form a CIO council. We'll call it the CIO Council of South Africa. And we will invite CIOs to it, and we'll start talking about the things that give us heartburn, that stresses us out, and that gives us major, major challenges. And that's how it started. We then looked for a sponsor to say, who can help us with this? And Microsoft was very quick to say, we see the value of this, and we're going to be the official sponsor for the CIO Council. So Microsoft signed up with us. And they have been working with us on setting up the council, scheduling the events. It has been held constantly at Summer Place, a beautiful venue in Sandton. And we do it 4 times a year. We try and do it on a Friday for about 3 hours. And it's usually in the morning so that the CIOs can get back to their offices for the weekend's releases and whatever they have to do for the weekends. The topics which we discuss, we always survey the CIOs of the previous event, say, what pains you, what gives you a major problem, what do you want to know about, is it strategic alignment, is it IT planning, is it architecture, is it business process management, is it ops dev, is it money, how to get funding for your function, is it business case management, what do you struggle with? And so the topics are very relevant, driven by the 200 CIOs. And what we do is we get together, we present, usually we have three or four speakers, and the topics are relevant to what CIOs are struggling with. We found it to be particularly interesting this year. Cybercrime was a hot topic. Board alignment and engagement was a hot topic. King 3, King 4, governance and compliance for technology to boards was a hot topic. Security, always a hot topic. And then other interesting speakers where they've done something very good with IT in their company, we get them to come and talk to us, success stories.
Yeah. All right. Mm. And you also mentor CIOs, rather. Yeah. You've, I think when we last spoke, you mentioned you're mentoring about 30 CIOs. Yeah. What does that entail?
Well, CIOs usually in the early years have to, you know, get through their jobs with not too much coaching and support. And so CIO started asking me at the council whether I have time to just help them. And I said, well, let's schedule some sessions. And it was ad hoc in the beginning, where some CIOs would meet with me and say, I'm struggling with my boss. He doesn't understand me. We talk about how we can overcome that. Second CIO, I don't have money to do my job. The CFO who just refuses to give me money. What can I do about that? And so it evolved. And so I said, okay, what capacity do I have? I then went to my bosses, because I've been doing it for quite a long time, and asked their permission to take some time and mentor CIOs. And they said, well, you can do that, but you must do it for your country, and you must do it for the good of South Africa's industry. So I've been doing that. I've got a specific template and way of doing it. And we talk about the issues that's relevant to that CIO. I've now switched to predominantly black female CIOs, because that's where the big ask is for. The country is looking for black female CIOs, and so I've been focusing on them primarily.
Is it mainly a male-dominated field?
I would imagine it is. Yeah. It's a very much a male-dominated field. But the women are coming through, and I've managed to, you know, as my role evolved in telecom, my group CIO role in telecom have been decentralized. So we formed five business units in telecom. OpenServe, Telcom Consumer, BCX, Trudon, V-Gaming, you know, and we've put business unit CIOs in those positions. And we have specifically focused on getting female black CIOs into those jobs. We've been very fortunate to do so, and I've been mentoring them and helping them as well, you know. But I also have some external CIO candidates which I meet from time to time, and they say, I've got this crisis, what can I do? This particular business boss is giving me a hard time, what can I do? I've just lost the top five people in my team, what am I going to do about that? Also, the topics change, but it's a very, very nice opportunity for me to just invest.
You've also reactivated the dormant business called the CIO Recruitment Firm. Yeah. Is that going to be a big focus for you post-Telcom?
Yeah, I mean, that company was started as I left APSA. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to do that after I, you know, decided to leave APSA. And so I formed the company, I registered it, built a website and started marketing it, got hold of lots of CIOs that were looking for new opportunities. And then, you know, the telecom thing happened and I had to put it on the back burner. So I'm revitalizing that. Again, a lot of people looking for CIOs. Obviously, the by and large, my database of top CIO candidates in South Africa are predominantly male white candidates, which is not always what the companies want. So I'm trying to place both white and black, and I'm trying to work with companies who are looking for these CIOs. And what's different about my approach is when a company is interested in a particular CIO, I would take that CIO and work with him or her in the company to launch him or her into that position by helping them put up their strategic plan, align that plan to the business, get their performance contract established, get the board governance in place, and get all the scorecards done. And then I step out and step back, and then they go on them by themselves, which I find to be things which the new companies like, because the risk is mitigated by and large.
Lynn, before I let you go today, are you, I know the term that was used when you left Telkom was retiring. Are you looking for another active CIO position still, or are you content with what you're doing here?
Duncan, I mean, having done FNB, APSA, Nedbank, Transaction Capital, Telkom, I don't think there's a big enough CIO job left. I think they are the biggest. And so I'm not looking for another CIO role or position. I am on the board of a couple of companies now as non-exec director. I chair the board of Moya Advisory Services, which is a very strong technical enterprise architecture company in Centurion. I'm also, as I said, on the board of Zonaco and Arise Investments. I'm on the board of EMAS Financial Services. I am on the advisory board of Pretoria University. I'm also helping PIC, Dr. Dan Machilla, with some of the challenges he's facing. And I'm working with the industry on challenges that comes up from time to time when board members phone me and say, we need help with this or that. I help them. So I have swapped from one full-day day job to six part-time jobs, so not really retired.
More than enough to keep you busy, by the sounds of it. Great stuff. Lynn, this has been a great discussion. Lynn de Villiers is chairman of the CIO Council of South Africa and a former CIO of Telkom Group and many other corporate entities in South Africa. Thank you so much for sharing your insights with Tech Central today.
Thank you, Duncan.